I like to think of Buddhist practice, and especially retreat practice, as a journey. And certainly Buddhism has used the metaphor of a path for going on this journey, and it's a journey that unfolds over time. And some of the way it unfolds and evolves and develops is not really your making. You create the conditions and something begins to unfold. On this first day of practice, many people, a lot of what's happening is you're just relaxing and letting go and unwinding and beginning to forget your concerns of everyday life. And some of that would happen if you were just spent the whole day in silence and just kind of wandered around and sat and had tea and looked at the clouds. A lot of that process of unwinding and letting go and settling would happen on its own. And it's nice to remember that, because sometimes one of the boogeymen, one of the challenges, is that we take so much responsibility for what's happening. Like, it's all up to me, and I have to make it work, and I have to fix the problem. It's nice to be reminded that there's a kind of a, something goes on here. If you just get out of the way, if you just let it unfold, just being here, you'll change. If you just were here, if you were here 7 days at this place and didn't meditate once, and just kept the silence, went to the meals on time, did your yogi job, looked at the clouds, you'd be a different person at the end. That would be a journey itself. Probably be valuable to do it. And so the idea is to just add meditation on top of it. It's kind of like cream on the cake. It's just a nice thing to add. It's a nice thing to do that can deepen it, as opposed to thinking that like meditation's like the only show in town and I gotta get onto it, and it's already the afternoon of the first day, and I'm not in the 32nd jhana yet. And so, you know, something is, amiss. And I'll puff and puff more tomorrow. It's more like cream on the cake to meditate. And just, there's a wonderful process going on here, and you want to support it and augment it and let it unfold. Let the journey move. Let the practice you as much as you do the practice. So the idea of a journey. The Buddha gave a wonderful fable of a person who worked in the woods, and explorer of the woods, worked in the woods, maybe gathered timber in the woods or something. And this person went into the jungles, into a place where it seemed like no one had ever been, and it was overgrown, and made their way into the jungle. And as the person found the way in the jungle, found that it was a road, an old road that was just barely any traces left, that was all covered over and almost covered over, and found that there was an ancient road in that jungle, and followed that road, followed the subtle traces deep into the woods, and lo and behold, found at the end of the road was a great capital, a great palace of an old time, you know, from a long, long time ago that had been forgotten. So the woods person then went back to the monarchs of the realm, the kings and the queens, and said, in your realm here, there's this road, and this road goes to this great palace and capital that's waiting for you to inhabit again. And so the king and the queen went, probably with support from a few other people, and began to clear that road and excavate the road and follow the road. They came eventually to the palace and cleared it all out and took up residence, and everyone was happy ever after. So this fable is talking, one of the reasons I like this fable a lot is that the path, the journey we're on, the path we're following in Buddhism, is considered to be an ancient path. It's already here. The Buddha didn't invent it. It's kind of built into the nature of who we are, that there is this path we can follow, this unfolding, this maturation that we can do. I think of it as a developmental model of human life that we have for children growing up. It doesn't stop because you've reached 21. That there's a higher and higher, you know, further realms of natural human development that are possible to tremendous states of maturity and freedom. And so, so there's this path that leads to that. And the Buddha is the one who found that ancient path. He's the wood person. And he found this ancient path, and was very, the traces were very faint, just like they're very faint in us initially. But then it's our task, once we kind of pointed out the path, is to clear the way, clear the path, so the path becomes easy to walk to, and it takes us to, a wonderful place to reside. One of the reasons I like this story so much is that the woodsman comes back and tells the monarchs of the realm. And if we take this analogy, then the Buddha, if the Buddha was a woodsman, guess who the monarchs are? It's you all. The Buddha's come back and teach all of us that you're the kings and the queens of the realm. And I see it as a kind of analogy that offers a tremendous respect and reverence and, to every human being. We're all kind of have this dignity and regal quality that or at least we're seen that way by the Buddha. So in this, in our dignity, and you know, being a dignified, worthy human being, we can walk this path. And that's a nice antidote to sometimes when people hear some of the teachings of Buddhism, like just let go, or there is no self, or something. It seems like it's kind of deflating. If you really had let go completely, and if there's, really don't be anybody, chances you'll be pretty depressed. Not a good scene to just have no desires at all. That's not the point, to have no desires. That's not the point to not exist and like you don't count. All of us count. All of us are important. This is why I think someone like the Buddha or anyone teaches Buddhism is out of tremendous valuing of each human life and the potential of each human life to become free of suffering, to be liberated. And there's a path to be followed to do it. And it's our task to find that path. And the path exists in our own hearts. The path exists in our own minds. It's not external, it's not out there. So there are many things to discover along this path. So if it's okay to change the analogy on you, the metaphor, switch gears. Imagine that you are standing up in front of a big wall. And in the middle of the wall in front of you is a door. And so you open that door and you step through the door and close the door behind you. And lo and behold, you find yourself in a nice balcony or terrace that has this tremendous, beautiful vista of rolling mountains going off, receding into the distance with beautiful deep valleys and snow-topped mountains and beautiful clear skies that continue for miles and miles and miles, and it's just like breathtaking to see this great big vista. And wow, it's nice to stand there and watch it. And then you turn around and you look at this wall again, and you're on the other side now, and you look at the door, and so you open the door and you step through again, back to where you were, close the door, and you, when you get to the other side, lo and behold, and there's this huge vista, this huge, endless array of mountains going off in the distance, and deep valleys and snow-covered mountaintops and skies that seem to go on forever and clear, and wow. But on this side, there's a road that goes down and meanders and follows its way into the distance. So the door for us is mindfulness, our capacity to be aware. And when we step in through the door of awareness to notice what's happening, there's two directions we can be aware. We can be aware of the world around us and the external world of people and things. And that's a huge world. It's a universe. And sometimes it's, beautiful, like snow-covered mountains. And sometimes it's, war-ravaged, terrible places. And sometimes it's a little bit of both. It's a huge universe out there to discover. And if you take the awareness and turn it inwards, there's also a huge universe inside. I think I think of the inner world as as big as the outer world. We think that, it's small because we think our heads are small. How much can we hold in there? you know, it's a, you know, this teeny little skull and this vast universe. How could be what in here be as big and as vast? Maybe it's vaster. They say there are more nerves in our brain than there are stars in the cosmos and the universe. Isn't that quite something? How could that be? And there's a lot going on in there. And so, you know, it's a whole universe in there to explore, and the sense of vastness of it in many different ways, I think something that slowly dawns on people who meditate. Now, the path is found in this inner world for the most part. But it doesn't take us away from the outer world, but it allows us to explore this inner territory of our mind and the ecology of our mind and the different ecosystem and the different species that live there and what goes on. And there also there can be, you know, beautiful vistas of snow-covered mountains and whatever else beautiful natural thing you see. Or it could be war-ravaged in there too. And you can find all kinds of things in there. But that's the area to explore. That's the area of developing ourselves. And you might complain that, well, that's, you know, just going in. What about the world and being connected to the world? What's fascinating is that if you do this inner exploration, that's what we do here in the retreat, close your eyes and just really start discovering what goes on in this in the inner world, that at some point you'll discover that the wall and the door was something you made up. It's just another part of that inner world that was created. And when you start seeing the wall and the door are just made up, then it can start dissolving and falling away. And there is no wall and no door separating you from the inside and the outside. And that's pretty cool. And that makes us in some ways quite intimate and connected to the world in a very different way than if we're standing on the terrace looking at it all at a distance, or being somehow the person who's gonna come, I'm by my wall looking out and seeing what's there. And then we return to the world, the outer world, in a very different state than we were before. So it's a kind of temporary strategic retreat that we do in our retreat, strategic withdrawal to explore something that many people never explore, never discover. So in this exploration, in this path, a very important element is concentration, samadhi. And samadhi is considered one element of the Eightfold Path, one element of a lot of different lists of that the Buddha has. I think of all these lists as being an attempt to try to make help us make some order or find some orientation with the vastness of our, and maybe the initially the, what seems very chaotic in our hearts and minds. It's so big and so vast and so chaotic and so many things going on. But when you start seeing the list and seeing how these different things work together, there's more order and there's more way of finding your way with it than helping it all settle down and relax and move towards freedom. So one of these elements that appears in a lot of different lists is concentration. It's one of the predominantly important faculties of mind that in Buddhist practice we want to develop. And it's a partner to mindfulness. They go hand in hand. And here's an image. I don't know if this will work for you, the image for concentration. I think of, there's a number of things I think about when I think of a concentration, someone who's really concentrated. And one of them is when I was practicing at the Mahasi Center in Burma, it's a very large meditation center in Burma. There were hundreds, sometimes thousands of people meditating there at the same time. I would walk to breakfast every morning in single file with all these monks and people. And we would walk by the women's meditation hall. And because it was a hot climate in Burma, the two long walls of this very big building were just big doors that opened, and they were usually stood completely open, so you can see right through. And the hall was big enough that it housed 500 women meditating. That's a lot of people. And the women, the Burmese women, when they meditate, they sit upright with tremendous dignity and strength, just really strong. The Burmese men, on the other hand, maybe, they slump. A typical Burmese monk who meditates, that I saw, meditates like this. And so you can get enlightened that way. So, you know, if those of you who don't care about, you know, the instructions that Max gave today, you know, you could just go. But generally, your back goes out if you do this. But the women, it was really impressive. They would sit this strong back, sit straight up, head held high, and there'd be 500 of them. We'd walk by, and they were unmoving, completely still. It was one of the great wonders of the world to see the power emanating from this meditation hall. That, to me, is an image of concentration. Stability, stillness, dignity, groundedness, here. Unapologetically here, just here. When I was about 10, I lived in Italy, and I took the bus back, public bus, back and forth from home to school. And on the way home, my bus stop where I got off was almost at the end of the line. And so back then there was a driver and a conductor. The conductor was the one who sold the tickets. And as we got near the end of the trip, he would bring out his ledger and all the different tickets he'd sold. He had these tickets on a roll. And there was, you know, one way, round trip, I don't know, all the different kinds, children, seniors, I don't know what, there all these different kinds of. And he would look at all the tickets he'd sold, and then he'd put them all very neatly into his ledger. And it'd take him a while to kind of lay it all out. And I discovered that if I sat in a particular seat on the bus, he would always come and sit in front of me. He had a place where he would do his work. And I could look over his shoulder and watch him put his numbers in his ledger. And if I did that, I started feeling really good. I started feeling really kind of like I'd feel warm or cozy, or I'd feel kind of unified and connected. And it just felt so, I felt like I kind of contented, deep contentment I felt. So I would always sit there to make sure that I would watch him. Because, you know, I had no idea what was going on. I didn't even think about it. It was like a Pavlovian thing, you know, for me. I was going to sit there because I wanted to watch that. I wanted to have that good feeling that came from watching him do his ledger. Many years later, when I started meditating, I realized I was getting concentrated. I was somehow, I got pulled into his concentration, or pulled into the activity, that my mind stopped being distracted or caught up in my concerns in school and this and that. It somehow, I got pulled in to this one thing, and I became unified, or I became whole, or I became, something dropped away, or you know, the word for concentration, a synonym for concentration is unified, being unified or whole. And, you know, so a nice, you know, it's another image or idea of, maybe you had something like that as a child. They say the Buddha had that as a child, that when he discovered the path to awakening, an important component of it, he had a childhood memory of when he was six, and where he had a similar experience of getting really, you know, having this really good feeling welling up, of being settled and concentrated, unified, and feeling this deep contentment well up. There's an image in Buddhism of deep concentration that's like taking and being wrapped in a very clean, coming out of the bath and being wrapping yourself completely enveloped in a very clean white blanket or sheet. And it doesn't quite work for me as an image for concentration. But what works is being 4 or 5 years old and putting the white bed sheets over the dining room table and making a tent and getting underneath and feeling so safe, so contented and so clean, and the light coming in, it feels so still, and there's all this noise around, but in there it was really quiet. And again, this feeling of being kind of safe and grounded and here, and is kind of an image for the samadhi. And so probably samadhi should not be translated as concentration. And the reason I don't think is probably the best translation is because many people in the West, people speak English, and you tell them to concentrate, they furrow their brows and kind of like getting really intense. You know, they bear down on something. And this idea that you're in the control tower and you're going to have this laser focus. Some people, when you tell them to get concentrated, they think they have to use their eyes. So even if their eyes are closed and they're meditating, it's interesting to see how often the eyes get engaged. You know, some people actually try to look at their breath through their eyes somehow when they're meditating. So this, you know, this contraction, this laser focus, this kind of bearing down, this kind of engaging the eyes to look and really kind of zero in, is sometimes people get. That's when, you know, when people, you know, they think they're supposed to concentrate, that's what they do. But the samadhi is meant to lead to a mind which is soft and pliable, a quiet mind or a still mind. And rather than the mind getting contracted, samadhi moves towards being expansive. Big mind is the expression some people use. And so even though the idea is one-pointed maybe, but one-pointed with an expansive mind. And now there's a number of reasons why samadhi, this concentration or composure or stability or steadiness, collectedness is another word used for samadhi, that you're collecting yourself, you're unifying. And one of the reasons why unification or collectedness is used is samadhi is the opposite of being scattered with the mind, or being distracted in the mind, or having the mind jump around to many different things and looking here and there, or being divided or split. Sometimes the mind is thinking about all kinds of things and not really present. Some time ago I was exercising, and I discovered a wonderful way of understanding the difference between attention that really helps us stay present, even with our thinking, and discursive thought, distracted thought. And that is, in some of the exercises I do, I count how many reps I do. 1, 2, 3, like that. And I've discovered that as I'm doing my counting and doing my things, I can start thinking about something else and keep the counting going. But what I'm thinking about, that's discursive thinking. Inevitably, that's thinking about conversations I've had or plans I'm making or fantasies I have or something. And for me, that might be, you might look at that. If you like, you might try using mental notes on your breath or count your breath for a while and then see if that would highlight the kind of thinking that's called discursive thinking. That is having a conversation which is taking you away, probably keeps you scattered, keeps you from being settled, kind of keeps you in this, in the ether zones. And that's what we can't stop thinking necessarily, but sometimes it's possible to quiet that discursive thought or to say, well, that's, I don't need to be there, and to feel that's not important. But sometimes it's hard to catch it and notice it. So maybe this helps. So a samadhi mind is a mind which is not scattered, it's not divided, it's not split, it doesn't have multiple agendas, different things going on. It's possible to have, we have so many different faculties operating all the time, this inner vastness that we have, so much going on in there. But all these different things we have could be not in harmony with each other. So for example, if you come to meditate before one of the meals here, and your intention is to be really present for your breath, really stay with your breath. That's your intention. But just before you came into the hall, you saw someone's shoes, and you realize you have old shoes, and probably you should be getting new shoes soon. And so you start thinking about the shoes you want to get. So you're thinking about shoes. But earlier, during the walking period before, you went to what, you know, the place you had done walking meditation earlier in the day, and someone was there first. My spot. The person, you know, the person saw you walking there earlier. I mean, obviously this is my spot. How could they be so rude to take my spot? And you're really irritated, and that irritation, the anger, didn't just dissipate quickly, but you, when you came to meditate, you had the intention to be on the breath. Your thoughts were about shoes, and the feeling, the emotional tenor and the tension in your body is lingering, is that annoyance with the person who did your walking meditation. And then because in their meal, your stomach gets hungry. And you start feeling, you know, it'd be nice to eat, you know, and feel this kind of gurgling and this kind of, you know, tightness in the stomach, a little hunger pangs. So you start seeing how complicated it gets, all these things going on at once, all these layers and things going on. We can go on and on, but that would probably be frightening. And so this is where these things are not in harmony. The idea is to have your intention, your thoughts, your emotions, your body's sensations, and whatever else you have, all harmonized, all collected together, so they're settled here on the same, you know, together, working together. That's samadhi. So it's not just a laser focus. So it's kind of a settledness, a settling into this. And so the simplification, the letting go that we do, is so that things can kind of be simpler, so everything kind of works together. Everything's here just for this, not scattered and distracted. So the one-pointedness of concentration practice is not so much that you're zeroing in on one point, it's more like the word center in concentration, that we're becoming centered on something. So I to help with this idea of concentration, for me what was helpful was to switch the word from concentration to concentric, and think of there being concentric circles. And the first concentric circle is the widest one, which is the widest possible kind of awareness of our present moment circumstances. We're here, no doubt about that. We're sitting, walking, we're here. But how big do you have to make your awareness to encompass the whole picture of what's going on for you in your life right now? And that can be quite wide. It can not only be, it can be things that are far away. It can be your background, your history, and your your ancestors might be here a little bit as well, and where you come from, and your experiences in life, and your hopes and aspirations, and fears, and you know, the whole shebang, to have a sense that you're going to include it all, open up really wide. All of you is allowed to be here. And you don't want to be divided and say, this is not acceptable, and this should be, you know, this is okay, I'm supposed to be focusing here, so I'm trying to bat everything away. I used to try the pinball machine meditation. I tried, you know, all kinds of creative things to try to help me with get concentrated. And one was the pinball. I would just imagine I was just kind of batting everything away, you know, and a thought would come, bing, not now, and they'd get rid of everything. And that, you know, sometimes it was kind of fun, but it wasn't very helpful. And but to take it, you know, what do you have to include? How wide does your attention have to get so that everything who you are can exist in one big kind of settled way? And that's an exercise that's sometimes done for people who have a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety or trauma or something, is how big and wide do you have to make your attention so it feels okay just to be with the fear and let it be there? And sometimes teachers will ask, can you imagine that your attention is as big as this room? If it's as big as this room, is it big enough to hold your fear? No. Well, this valley that we're in, now what if we could get the whole valley here, the vineyard, and across the little hill across there, if it was that big, is that big enough to really, you know, if you can watch it from that kind of vantage point, you know, is it big enough for it to be with your fear then? No. Well, what about if you were, you know, an airplane, you know, high up in the sky looking down in Santa Cruz County, Oh, then I can be present for my fear. From that, if I see it from that big space and make that much space for my fear, then I can hold it. So, you know, you can kind of separate and open up and expand. And how big of a scope do you have to have so you can just let things be and just be there? So then, and this, what this kind of exercise does is to reinforce the idea we're supposed to be whole. We want to try to be complete. We're not trying to fight ourselves. One of the definitions of meditation that I love is the continual act of befriending yourself. Isn't that nice? Continual act of befriending yourself. So make yourself whole. Be kind. Have space for it all. But not so much as to accept it. You know, like everything's to be accepted, but to hold it all in a generous, kind way. So the widest concentric circle. And then to begin relaxing, softening. Then, kind of in that space, begin letting go of your discursive thoughts and find a place that's closer in, a concentric circle that's closer, more intimate to yourself, more close here. Because in the wide concentric circle, some of that's going to be a virtual reality. Some of it has a lot to do with the world of thoughts and memories and plans and imaginations and all that. And it's not that intimate. It's kind of a little bit, sometimes a little bit, you know, removed from here. But if you get really intimate, it's kind of getting closer. A concentric circle that's right here. Can you come in here and just feel your body? Your body like a mountain just sitting here strong and regal. Feel your body and what is it? Can you kind of have a circle of attention that's close in and just here and feel your body, feel your mind, feel your feelings. What's happening here in the present moment? And again, not to cut anything out, but even if you're thinking about the past and the future and things far away, to really begin feeling that's happening here and now. Here and now, there's a more intimate circle. And then begin to rest and accept and be here for that. Center yourself here. So the idea is to keep centering yourself here and let things become simpler. Samadhi, another word for samadhi is simplicity. Let yourself become simpler and simpler. Samadhi shouldn't be an engineering feat. It's more of a simplification, process of simplification. And then let your concentric circle become even more intimate, closer. And is there some place, a real place of stability or center or stillness or something closer in? And one of the possibilities is breathing. Let that be your concentric circle, more intimate concentric circle. And begin simplifying yourself on the breath. So rather than focusing and tightening around the breath, can you simplify? Let things fall away. Let the other things, thoughts, concerns fall away. More of a process of letting go, or letting go into the breath. I love the expression letting go into. Letting go, some people don't like the word letting go, it's the activity. But to let go into, because letting go means you don't have anything, you release something. But letting go into means that the process of letting go, you get something in return. There's something, letting go into something good, it's like, that's good. It's a hot day and you let yourself go into the pool, the cool pool to be refreshed. So to let go into your breath. So let go of your thoughts, but let go into the experience of breathing in and out. Let go into the concentric circle which is within your body, inside. Get closer. And then to develop the samadhi, it helps a lot to have continuity of attention. If attention is not continuous over time, then it's because it's jumping around. It's scattered. It's not so settled. And so as we get closer and closer and finally can able to stay there with the breath, then we're going to stay and try to see if we can extend how many breaths we stay. Not by forcing it, but by letting go into it, by relaxing and softening. And so maybe initially you can just stay with one breath, maybe two breaths, and then maybe you get to 3 or 4, and then 10, and maybe 15, and then, you know, then slowly as you, and it's not a matter so much of getting stronger and stronger, the ability to stay focused, and it's not bearing down, But it's more like, and it has a lot to do with just letting go of the forces of distraction. The energy of distraction begins to abate. And so we're less pulled by everything. Or we become less and less interested in all the things we can think about. A lot of wisdom in practice occurs when you begin losing interest in some of those things that your mind is so interested in. And one way to help you lose interest is to take a moment to reflect that on your top three tunes, top three things you think about, how often have you done it? How repetitive is your mind? How many times you just, you know, kind of repeat the same thing over and over again and different angles, different, you know, have the conversation and same fantasy or same activity of planning or something. And some people, when they realize that, you know, how often they do it, they begin, you know, maybe I don't need to do it anymore. But, you know, it can be so interesting if it's just, you know, and one of the reasons it's so interesting, our thinking, is for many of our thinking, you're the main subject. You're part of the character. It relates back to you. And if you think about how often you're thinking about yourself over a lifetime, maybe you can put it down a little bit. Take a little vacation. You know, it's good to take vacations. The mind could use it. And so this thing about simplification, you know, losing interest in your thoughts, you know, saying, you know, put them up in the shelves and say, I'll think about that later. I don't need to do that now. There's a lot of wisdom in that, provided that you're not creating a division or divide or pushing something away. The idea is to stay whole. Nothing gets excluded, but things get simpler and simpler, just settled and settled. The image that's used for a samadhi mind, the traditions, a lot of images. The tradition uses a lot of images to help teach. I think there's something about images that speaks to a part of the mind that's different than kind of a linear conceptual mind. And the image, one image is that of a lot of the images of concentration have to do with water. And one image is that of a pond that has muddy water. And if you leave the pond alone, it's been stirred up, you know, the cattle have gone through it or something, and it's all muddy. And if you leave the pond alone, the mud will settle and the pond will get clear. But if you take a big stick and keep stirring up the pond, then the mud won't have a chance to settle. So our mind, it can be like this, that it wants to settle the mud, the thinking, the concerns, the preoccupations of our mind. The mind really wants to settle. It's what it wants to do. But we keep getting interested or involved or keep doing things with our mind that keeps the mud, the activity going. But the mind gets quieter and quieter. It gets clearer and clearer, simpler and simpler. A mind that's concentrated is also a mind that becomes clearer and clearer. So one of the great advices that I was given to help not stir up the pond anymore is don't be bothered by your thinking. If you're bothered by your thinking when you're meditating, that being bothered is just stirring it up. If you think, I have a problem, it's terrible, I shouldn't be thinking so much, I have to fix this, all this thinking, there's a way in which that just kind of keeps the whole thing cycle going. So there's an art, the skill, to learning to be kind of relaxed and at ease about your thinking mind. Don't make it an enemy. Don't make it a problem. But also, don't feed it. Don't make it a problem. Don't fight it. But also, you know, it's okay to let go of it too. Just let it fall away. Come back to this innermost concentric circle. Maybe just breathing. And then maintain a continuity with the breath. And, you know, over and over again. So when I was a kid, in the second grade, first grade playground, second grade playground, I remember, we had a sandbox. And some of the kids would come with these little red U-magnets. And we would take the magnets and pull them across the sand because there's all this little iron, black iron flints or something in the sand. And if we kind of went like this, those little flints, is that what they're called? They would line up, kind of, in the sand. Because we have to do it over and over again, like, you know, just stroke it over and over again, and things would line up. So the same thing with something like the breathing or the walking, as you do walking meditation, just keep doing it. Keep doing, give yourself over to it. Let go into it. Don't try too hard, but do give yourself over to it. And then it's the repetition, doing it again and again. Things begin to line up. The magnet works. And so this lining up, this unification, the different scattered faculties that we have slowly begin to come in and get settled to be here with the breath, with, you know, focused here. So concentration is part of this great inner landscape that we can discover and explore. It's a wonderful thing to discover. It's wonderful to explore. It's something that's learned slowly. Your mind and your mind's relationship to concentration, and the concentration itself is connected to a series of different factors, as Max said last night. So we're going to, over these next few days, talk about some of these different elements of the terrain, of the ecosystem, having to do with concentration. And we'll talk about especially the five jhanic factors. And so I'll tell you what they are. The first is, if you want to be settled on something, focused on something, you turn your mind towards it, or you settle on it. And so that's called the initial application of attention. The second factor is then called the sustained application of attention, which means to stay there with it. An analogy that's given in the ancient texts is that of a bird which is going to take flight. And initially it has to flap its wings, but once it's gotten up in the air, it can just hold its wings and ride the updrafts and fly. Or the image of a bee that's found a flower, and it's buzzing around the flower, and then at some point it lands in the flower and does what it does with flowers. And so the initial application is kind of flapping the wings or getting focused or getting, you know, flying around the flower, being there. And then we settle on what we're focusing on and stay there. So those are the first two jhanic factors. The next two have to do with well-being. The first is joy, and the second is, I like to translate the second as happiness. We'll talk more about it. And then the fifth is usually called one-pointedness. But again, maybe it's an accurate translation, but it also easily gives the wrong impression, just like the word concentration gives the wrong impression. It's like this laser focus again. It's more like if you're really settled at the middle of a circle, you're at the middle, the center point. So it's when you're deeply concentrated and have this one-pointedness, means you're really settled on the center point, really more of a settled feeling, just here. And everything is kind of just, there's a visceral feeling almost in the body of just being just really here at the center. So these are the five jhanic factors, and there are five faculties that we all have in our minds, the capacities we have. If we present it to you mostly from the point of view of meditation practice, that might be fine. But as you hear what we have to teach these days, a couple of things you might consider is, rather than thinking of these factors as something that you've never had before, this like esoteric Buddhist, you know, meditation experiences, why don't you think about them more, that you've already had experience in these. These are all operated for you. And see if you can identify when in your life these happened, when they were there for you, and when they came into play. See if you can find them in yourself, in your background. And in fact, if you are reading a really good novel that or doing a really good hobby, and you're really absorbed in it, some of these jhanic factors come into play, and including the well-being and the happiness and the settledness and the one-pointedness. It doesn't require meditation. And in fact, I suspect that a really good distraction has the jhanic factors there as well. You know, but you're not in control, or you're not so, you know, present for it. But, you know, there's one-pointedness, there's, you know, absorption, there's all kinds of things going on. So you have this capacity. We're not talking about the rocket science. And the last thing I'll say about this, that hope is encouraging, not discouraging. And hope saying that protects me. And that is that the amount of concentration that you need to meditate is the amount of concentration you needed to take the written exam at the DMV. You know, so I suspect most of you didn't like answer one question, then go off and get tea and answer another question, start thinking about where should I go tomorrow for dinner, and didn't answer another question, and you know, like start thinking about your childhood, you know, vendettas that you had, and do another question, and then kind of like think like, you know, what am I, what's the purpose of life, why am I here, and I could be doing something different than taking an exam right now. I could be doing something wonderful, you know, and why did I choose the exam today? I could be at the beach. And then you're back into another question, and then you're thinking, oh, you know, maybe I had chose the wrong pencil to do this exam, and you know, I'm sure someone has a better pencil for me, and they didn't really give me good instructions about how to do this exam, and these people, they don't know what they're talking about, you know. And then you do another, you know, mostly you kind of did it, right? I hope. So we're not talking about something really difficult. What's difficult is to remember to do it and to hang in there to do it. But the faculties, the things that are used for developing the samadhi, are ordinary faculties you all have. And so it's just beginning to appreciate. So hopefully Max and I will lay out the terrain of these jhanic factors, and that you'll begin recognizing them in yourself. And as you recognize some of the factors, recognize how they work, recognize how the mind works, recognizing how the mind gets distracted, how it gets scattered, how it gets divided, start seeing that, always remember, the process of meditation is continual befriending of yourself. It's okay. And then remember, sometimes you need to open up and make your circle really wide to see, have a wide, open, accepting awareness of what's there. Because if you don't do that, you might be at war with yourself, struggling unnecessarily, trying to get concentrated too quickly. Open up and relax. Accept, see what's there, let it all be there. And then take the steps to come closer in, more intimate. Come back to the intimate stillness, quietness, softness, pliableness, stillness that's here. And it's some of the most satisfying experiences of life that are here in samadhi. It's very healing. It's very healing to have this kind of sense of wholeness, completeness, unification of samadhi. Okay. So it's the custom here at IRC and many retreat centers is at the end of our Dharma talk is to return to our meditation posture and take a couple of minutes to kind of gather yourself together, settle in. And with the help of your body, your breath, your mind, to let yourself come back into your practice mode. Come back in, be reminded, here you are. Check in. Take a moment to hold it all in a wide concentric circle of awareness. And then taking maybe a couple of deep breaths and settling in, closer concentric circle, just here.